to string theory. We are going to follow the standard route into the subject, which is to learn string perturbation theory. The Polchinski is a typical reference for this kind of material. On the wiki, I believe you'll find also lecture notes, which cover essentially all the material we'll go through the lectures. The lecture notes are from last year, but I will update them as lectures progress. Most of the lectures are going to be somewhat technical in nature. We'll have to acquire a lot of tools in order to learn how to define string perturbation theory. These are tools that will also presumably be helpful in learning quantum field theory. They typically have a dual use. Today's lecture is not going to be technical. I'm just going to try to give an overview of what string perturbation theory is. How does it fit more or less inside string theory and inside theoretical physics in general? So I would like to start describing what string perturbation theory is. Now, as the term suggests, string perturbation theory is a perturbative theory of strings. It describes the behavior of some string-like objects, which propagate mostly freely through space-time and occasionally interact with each other. So concretely, perturbative means that physical quantities, such as the elements of a scattering matrix, are written as formal series in some coupling. It starts from some free values and then systematically correct them . This is not intended to be a true expression in the sense it's really a formal power theory. The coupling is essentially imagined to be infinitesimal. And it's usually a good description of the physics when the coupling is not infinitesimal, but it's small. But it's not a definition of a theory. Now, this is completely analogous to what happens in quantum field theory, except in quantum field theory, you're typically given a semi-rigorous definition of what you're talking about. So typically, for example, you could say, okay, my amplitude is computed by a path integral. And then you can worry about how well defined this path integral is. You might have to work very hard to make it rigorous. But there is a starting point. It has some free action corrected by some interactions. And as you expand the answer in formal power series and interactions, you get something like this, schematically. This is not the only way you could imagine producing a self-consistent answer. There are other ways to try to arrive at a perturbation theory for quantum field theory, which just start from sort of try to bootstrap themselves. You start from some particles, some interactions, and then systematically try to build something which is self-consistent, unitary, and whatever else, whatever other constraints you want. And sometimes those methods can actually be more effective than doing Feynman diagrams. But the situation in string theory is rather different, at least in string perturbation theory, what we're going to do in this course. We just start with a perturbative definition. Then you can worry if there could or not be some non-perturbative intrinsic definition which can produce this answer as a formal expansion in the couplings. In some circumstances, there are some non-perturbative definitions of string theory, but at the moment, we don't have an overarching definition which is valid in every possible situation you can imagine. Finding a full non-perturbative definition of string theory is a very important open problem. It's also a very hard problem, presumably. Now, there is a graphical picture which should make rather clear what string perturbation theory, how string perturbation theory works. Now, when you in quantum field theory, you have things like Feynman diagrams, which represent elementary perturbative processes in your theory. So you can draw some pictures, so you have time, space, you send in some particles, maybe different types, they will interact. You might emit some other particles, exchange some other particles. Almost everywhere these particles behave like they're free. And then at specific points in space-time, interaction vertices, the particles can interact with each other. But they always only interact when they are at the same point in space-time. Is sort of at least that's what happens in local quantum field theory. So these are the kind of pictures that this intuitively tell you what happens in a perturbation in a perturbation theory for a quantum field theory. So particles are almost by definition things with no space extension. They're point-like objects in space which propagate in time. Now a string is a one-dimensional object in space which propagates in time. Let's start with closed strings. It's just loops, featureless loops elementary loops. And then as they propagate in space, time, they describe two-dimensional surfaces in space-time called worksheets. And, you know, the strings will interact with each other in some very simple way. So particles interact by coming together at the same point and then becoming some other particles. Strings interact by touching and perhaps reconnecting. So here I have two strings that are coming together, and at some point they might reconnect. Now I'm trying to draw a process which is analogous to this one. And perhaps that would be even recognizable, although my drawing skills are somewhat limited. So I'm trying to depict the fact that there are these tubes which are coming. So this is trying to represent a surface made of tubes that are connected to each other. And if you stare at it for a while, you can see sort of a topological resemblance to this picture. I have two closed strings that are coming in. They decide to exchange another string. Then this emits another string. And so on. So string perturbation theory tries to put some numbers behind these pictures. Okay? And so we spent a few lectures trying to figure out how to get a scattering amplitude out of a picture like this. And then, much like in quantum field theory, where you sum over all possible Feynman diagrams, you're going to get the amplitude of string perturbation theory by summing over all possible topologies of these kind of pictures. Do you have any questions? Okay. Please ask, feel free to ask questions. There will be a bit time in the lectures to answer questions. And it makes the interaction more useful. Now, the resemblance between string theory and quantum field theory becomes very sharp at low energy. So, as we will see, the action of a string contains some intrinsic length scale, something called the tension, which is very analogous to the mass of a particle. And the tension pretty much controls roughly how big is a string. which means that if you work at very low energy or very large length scales, the string is going to look like a point, like a particle. This is completely analogous to the statement that if I take a proton, it has structure. If I heat it hard, I can see the structure. But if I study process at low energy, the proton is, behaves like a particle. It can exchange other particles, but it's very hard to break it at low energy. Now, well, the same can be true of, a molecule, an atom. And much like those systems that have internal structure, excited states of the system behave like other particles. So the same hydrogen atom at very low energy might look like a variety of different particles, because each excited state of the hydrogen atom will behave like a different type of particle, have different energy, different mass, different properties. Of course, most of the excited states will be unstable and will decay, but at low energy they'll behave like particles, different particles. So in a similar way, a string, an individual string, might look like many different particles. We'll put just one type of string in our theory, but we'll get out of it an infinite tower of particles of increasingly high energy. So there will be some spectrum. Of string states will have some low-lying states and then some excited states. And the magnitude of these gaps, the magnitude of these masses will be controlled by the tension of the string. And it just so happens that for well-defined string theories, the lowest mass states have actually zero mass. So a well-defined string theory will have some massless spectrum, and on top of at low energy, will look like a theory of massless particles, and on top of it, there will be some extra massive particles, an infinite tower of them. So it's literally true that if you take this picture and you look at it at very low energy, you're looking at strings that were coming in slowly from far away, then it will look like this. Different types of lines might represent different states of the string, which interact with each other. On the other hand, when you start probing the system at high energy, then the fact that these are strings and not particles becomes manifest. You know, if you hit the proton hard, it will you'll see structure inside. If the you'll see that when the protons collide, they're not the protons that are colliding. The protons are like fluffy things, and inside there are the quarks which are colliding with each other. Now strings are just fluffy. There are no particles inside the string. So at high energy, the strings behave like two balls of fluff that hit each other. They don't hit each other very hard. So the scattering amplitudes will grow much, will behave much better, in a sense, at high energy than what happens with particles. And the interactions, too. See, somehow the interaction where several particles come together at a point are harsher than the sort of interactions that strings have, where several tubes come together smoothly. So this manifests. So towards the beginning of the course, we'll encounter two very striking facts. The first is that the spectrum includes a massless graviton. So one of the particles here is a graviton. The second fact is that the perturbative expansion is well defined, is well behaved at high energy. So things are UV finite, and Also, even at the three level, they don't grow polynomially in energy the way gravitons do, graviton scattering amplitudes do. So, well behaved time energy. Well, these two are related in the sense that the properties of looped amplitudes follow from the properties of three-level amplitudes. But I would just want to stress it's not just a matter of having some UV divergences or not. It's really a physical property of the behavior at high energy. So these are the first reason we study string theory. String theory is a theory of quantum gravity. So it includes gravitons in the spectrum at low energy. Right, so I'm not making, you know, some statement about the quantum nature at space-time at short scales or anything complicated. It's just something very pedestrian. There is a perturbative expansion of a theory which has gravitons, and it's well behaved. So Einstein gravity is a perfectly good low energy effective field theory. You can do calculations, you send gravitons in, you see what comes out. There are problems with normalizability, which just means that there will be some times in your effective action which you need to measure from experiments at the end. But the problems happen when you start trying to go at high energy. When you collect gravitons at higher and higher energy, the scattering amplitudes start growing polynomially, you start getting in trouble. At some point, by the time you get to the Planck scale, something must have happened. Your perturbation theory is just not working anymore, and gravity has to be replaced by something else. Now, you can imagine two scenarios. It's gravity all the way to the Planck scale, and then something happens, or something happens before you get to the Planck scale, before you get a strong coupling. So in string perturbation theory, you get the second possibility. You start increasing the energy, but much before you get to the Planck scale, you hit the string scale, everything becomes fluffy. And the problems of gravity just go away.
In string theory, what is the background of the string moving around? Like, is it flat space-time?
I'll get to it in a moment. It's actually literally the next thing. But first I want to do some, I wanted to just say, so both possibilities can be realized. On one hand, there might be other ways to complete gravity at a perturbative level at some energy scale, which is much slower than the Planck scale. There are strong indications that whenever you want to do that, you need something similar to string theory. In a sense, there are all sorts of theorems or semi-theorems that it's very hard to correct the problems of gravity just by adding a bunch of new particles. You really need to add infinitely many of them. And this is what string theory does. Each string gives you an infinite tower of particles. They actually have arbitrary high spin. Each individual particle in this tower behaves as bad as the graviton or even worse. But together they conspire and the scattering amplitude is resummed to something well behaved. It would be great to have a general recipe of how to make this happen. String theory just gives some recipe. Now, there is also the other possibility that things are fine with gravity all the way to the Planck scale and then something else happens. M theory is an example of that. In M theory, there is nothing. All the things that you add to gravity kick in at the Planck scale, pretty much. Okay. Now, right. Now I can get to the question. So, both in quantum field theory and in string theory, when you start your calculations, there is a possibility of picking some backgrounds. For example, there are a lot of parameters. First of all, I could say, okay, I pick the coupling. That's a continuous choice. And then perhaps I can even make the coupling to be a position, a function of position. I can describe, I can couple the quantum field theory to all sorts of backgrounds. You know, the typical example is a background space-time. I can say, okay, I take my scalar field, and I write an action for it. Which depends on some background metric. That's fine. You can do it in quantum field theory. You can do it in string perturbation theory. Now, if your quantum field theory included a graviton, then automatically the field for this graviton would combine with the background metric. So I call this, let me put a bar on the background metric. If you start coupling a scalar field to a graviton, you'll discover that self-consistency forces the graviton to couple to it this way. So what started its life as a background choice, the choice of space-time in which my quantum field theory lives, becomes dynamical if I add a graviton, but I need to add it. Now, in string theory, this always happens automatically. The reason for which there was a graviton here was precisely that I had a freedom to couple the string to a background, space-time. Any other continuous choice I can make will automatically produce a dynamical field. There are particles in the spectrum for every choice of continuous background, including the coupling itself. So in string theory, even if I start with some formal expression like this, or this was some number, I soon discovered there is actually a field in the theory called the dilaton. A scalar field whose magnitude controls the magnitude of the coupling. So string theory turns out to have, string perturbation theory turns out to have no continuous parameters. Now, this was a rather celebrated fact about string theory because it resonates well with sort of the dream that is in the back of the head of most theorists, which at some point we have done enough experiments. We have figured out some underlying fundamental theory from which we can just compute the low energy theory, and we'll be done. You know, the dream of finding the theory of everything. We find the theory, it's unique. You cannot tune it in any way. You do some calculation, you see that it works, and you're done. And so in the beginning, people got very excited because of this. Now, and it is very exciting. Instead of having many different string theories, at the end we discover there is just one string theory. But it has sort of a dark side. It makes you dream, and then it kills the dream very quickly. Because if all of these complicated choices can be dynamical, it means you really need to understand the dynamics. Even worse, different things can happen dynamically. Which universe you see, which laws of nature do you see around you, might be the result not of a complicated calculation, but just of some dynamical process. They might depend on initial conditions. They might depend on where you live. So string theory, in a sense, I mean, you might believe or not that string theory describes the universe. That's irrelevant. The point is that string theory gives you a proof of principle that the same underlying theory can manifest itself in many different ways. So it becomes very hard to really believe that you could bootstrap yourself all the way to the shortest possible scales without going and checking at every energy scale what's going on. Now, of course, precisely in order to really understand what's going on, we would need to have a non-perturbative understanding, a full non-perturbative understanding of the theory. You see, once the coupling is dynamical, once your theory can span very different They say, how, once the dynamic can span very different realities, you need to understand the non-perturbative dynamics of the theory to figure out which realities are actually possible, which laws of nature can really emerge from your underlying theory. And this is something that is very hard with the tools that we have available at the moment. Okay. So, okay, this was a bit perhaps too much philosophy, but going back to the concrete things that we're going to do in the course, after we describe state perturbation theory for closed strings, we're going to add another ingredient, which is really what has made string theory explode over the last 20 years, which is something called D-brains, which D-brains somehow allow us to access some non-perturbative information within the context of perturbation theory. They're somewhat strange objects. Now, the starting point is rather simple. Here we're studying closed loops of elementary closed loops, featureless. You can ask what happens if I allow myself to also study open loops. No, maybe I should make it wavy. Now, a closed loop has no special point, but an open loop has endpoints, which are somewhat different from the inside. So if you want to define an open string theory, you need to give me extra information. You need to tell me what happens at these endpoints, to give me some boundary conditions. There are many possible choices, and they can actually coexist. So you can have a situation where you have your theory has some closed strings. Maybe it has some open strings which have, let's say, blue endpoints. Do I have a blue chalk? Okay, orange endpoints, which are allowed to be everywhere you want in space-time. And maybe they will have also red endpoints, sorry, green endpoints, which are constrained to live on some submanifold, say a two-dimensional submanifold in space-time. And maybe red endpoints. Constrained to live on some line in space-time. So here I build my theory by allowing three different boundary conditions. Boundary conditions where the endpoint can float freely, boundary conditions where it's constrained to live here, boundary conditions where it's constrained to live here. All of a sudden, it looks like I've gotten a lot more choices than before. And this picture, this is a picture at some moment in time, and then you can draw pictures evolving in time. Now, here is going to be really tricky, but I should be able to do it. Okay, let's see. So let's say that I start with some open string, which has an orange endpoint and a red endpoint. And then I'm going to have this evolve like this and like this. Then okay. Okay. Hope this looks like a two-dimensional surface, which has some tubes. and some ribbons. The ribbons open up, can open up into other ribbons. The tubes can attach themselves to the ribbons. So now I have all sorts of new processes. You know, I can have a closed string which opens up to an open string. Well, just like it. I can have an open string which is splitting. So on and so forth. So as you see, my interactions always consist of strings joining smoothly, and occasionally new boundaries can appear, again, smoothly. So the boundaries kind of behave like particles, but they never interact at points. All the interaction is mediated through the strings. Okay. Now, here there are a lot of apparent new choices. I picked this surface, I said it's here. I picked this curve, I said it's here. But as usual, every continuous choice becomes a particle. So now my theory has a lot of new particles which arise from open strings. And some of these new particles become fields which allow you to change your continuous choices. So on top of this, there will be a bunch of fields which control the fluctuation of this object. On top of this, there will be a bunch of fields which control the fluctuations of this membrane. So these things that I insert as external probes in the theory end up being dynamical objects. This is called D-brains. So my theory has suddenly gained a whole new dynamical sector, new excitations, which I didn't know were there. That's right. The place where I let my endpoints live. They start their life with infinite mass, infinite tension, but then by this process, they gain finite but very large mass. So as long as I'm in perturbation theory, as long as my coupling, string coupling is very weak, these are very heavy, very rigid objects. And then if I start exploring regions of the parameters where the coupling becomes bigger, they become more and more dynamical. And at some point, ultimately, they end up on the same footing as strings. So. And I mean, it takes a bit of work, but there are ways to demonstrate that these D-brains are really a part of the theory. After you put them in by hand, you can then afterwards argue that they were already there in the closed string theory. You can compute certain quantities, so you can really see that some heavy objects with these quantum numbers had been secretly integrated out in the theory of closed strings. So as I said, there are reasons to believe that these objects end up in the underlying theory, end up on democratic footing with the string, with the original strings. And this brings us to the subject of dualities. And in order to discuss dualities, I need to mention something called supersymmetry. So supersymmetry is a property of almost all well-defined string theories. It's not a theorem. In principle, you can write down theories of strings which are well defined, which don't have supersymmetry. Supersymmetry is a symmetry relating the bosons and the fermions of your theory. At the most basic level, it plays a role in string theory by allowing some cancellations between bosons and fermions in these infinite powers, which make the behavior of the theory better. In particular, eliminates some tachyons, which otherwise would pop up in the theory. So I said that the lowest mass was zero. There is a, in string theory, there is a relation between the behavior at the bottom of the tower and the behavior high up in the tower. So in order to get something that has zero mass at the bottom, you need some sort of constellations high up in the tower between bosons and fermions. And supersymmetry makes it happen automatically. It's possible to make it happen without supersymmetry. The reason supersymmetry usually is there is that supersymmetry makes calculations easier. In a sense, the constellations between bosons and fermions inside Feynman diagrams allow certain quantities to be protected from quantum effects. For example, once I told you that there was a scalar field which controls the coupling, you might have gotten worried. It is, what if the scalar field is a potential which makes the coupling go, become large? Then automatically I have a perturbation theory which is not self-consistent because it's not expanded around the vacuum. String theory removes the potential for the dilaton. Supersymmetry removes the potential for the dilaton, and it makes the perturbation theory well defined. So when you consider supersymmetric string theories, your perturbation theory is automatically well defined. This doesn't mean that string theory has to be perturbed but supersymmetric. It's more like with the tools which we have available, we can mostly study supersymmetric string theories. So you know, if you have a lamppost, you look under the lamppost, there might be a lot of stuff away. But anyway, so supersymmetry gives you the possibility of doing some calculations precisely in perturbation theory. It removes a lot of quantum correction for some, from some questions. In particular, like it allows you to trust expressions for the mass of, for example, for the masses of tensions of these brains or these deep brains or for some of their couplings away from the perturbative regime. So when people added deep brains to the theory, they realized that there were a lot of symmetries. That, for example, elementary strings and elementary string deep brains, one-dimensional deep brains, had a lot of properties in common if you allowed yourself to vary the coupling. And in particular, it seemed reasonable to even conjecture that if you made the coupling very large, and these deep brains became lighter and lighter, at some point they might replace the usual strings. And you might encounter a new perturbative description based on these deep brains. So in the course of a few years, a nice picture emerged, which is described by traditionally by a kind of a blob. So I said that in string theory there are no continuous parameters. There are still, in string perturbation theory, there are no continuous parameters. There are still discrete choices. In particular, if you look for theories that have no, that you can surely trust, that have no tachyons, no potentials that bring the coupling to large values or things like that, you find roughly a handful of choices. For example, these are not all the choices, but let me just draw these ones. There's something called type 2 strings, type 2A and type 2B. Something called heterotic strings. Can you remind me until what time am I allowed to go? Is it 11:15? 15, okay, excellent. Okay. And inspection of the properties or the protected properties of this theory suggested that they might actually be all connected. So each of these cusps I'm drawing represent a perturbative expansion in some coupling. This coupling is actually a scalar field. And there is a lot of evidence that there is an underlying theory, which we don't know how to define, which has some parameter, some dynamical parameter space, and in some corners of this parameter space agrees with these perturbative expansions. So this sort of underlying object is what we really call string theory. So string perturbation theory is what gives us access to some corners, dynamical corners of string theory. In these corners, string theory is really a theory of strings. There are some objects which are light and behave like strings, and then there are some very heavy objects which are described maybe by D-brains or by some other modification of perturbation theory. And there are surely other corners where it doesn't look like a theory of strings. For example, there is an empty theory corner I mentioned before, where there are gravitons, and then there are some Planck-scale extra objects, membranes or and fibrains on top of that. And there are presumably a lot of other corners which we just cannot access because they're not described by a simple perturbation theory.
Are those brains are fixed by hand, or are those brains are also included inside the expansion of the perturbation theory?
So there is a vast range of possibilities, things you can add to the perturbation theory. And each of them corresponds to some dynamical object of the underlying theory. Let me perhaps give an example in quantum field theory. I suppose you're studying the theory of electrons. Okay. But you want to model a situation where there is an actual proton there. What do? You're going to add to the action of electrons and photons an extra term which tells you that there is a source here for photons. And it's just some background thing you put by hand. It doesn't move. Or you might say it follows this trajectory. Again, it's a choice you made. You put there. And then actually things like conservation of energy might even constrain the trajectory that was actually, that you could actually pick. So in a similar way, if you're trying to describe some process in this underlying theory in this corner, you have to tell me which D-brains you put in. That's a choice you made. And then you can describe the dynamic of strings in the background of those D-brains.
Can I understand the brain as a fundamental object, which is also just the realistic stuff, like the string?
It's definitely a fundamental object. It's not made of strings, in a sense. I mean, sometimes you can think about it as a soliton made of strings. But often they carry quantum numbers that the strings just don't carry. It's best to think about it as an extra object in your theory, which happened to be very heavy in the limit where you can do perturbation theory. And so it's treated as an external source. And we will learn how to figure out which equations of motion this object must have. But right, essentially every consistent choice you can make of boundary condition predicts the existence of an object in the underlying theory. Yes, I didn't include type 1s here for, because type 1s are not really new string theories. It's a bit imprecise, but they correspond to taking one of these theories and adding some D-brains that fill the whole of space-time.
They use some additional objects, so you don't call them that.
It's semantics. So those are theories of open and closed strings, where you put both something called orientifold or orbifold that modify the closed strings behavior, and you add some open strings to eliminate some inconsistencies. But yes, I could have just put another horn here. I just didn't feel like it. Now, most of the course, we are not going to, most of the time during the course, we're not going to be in here. Because for simplicity, we'll study something called bosonic string theory, which has no supersymmetry, no fermions in the spectrum, has a tachyon, so it's not very well defined.
Mm-hmm. You told that string theory can predict a massless graviton.
Yes.
Which, so I suppose it basically works as a linear perturbation, like a linear field propagating in flat space.
Mm-hmm.
Like can you go beyond this order, like to higher order corrections and see if it does to match GR?
It has to. So it's in a sense, because it does, but it's not a big property of string theory. In a sense, this is a fact about quantum field theory. Whenever you put a massless to spin two particle in quantum field theory, it has universal couplings with everything else. So it's a graviton. It always ends up being a graviton. It couples to the stress tensor and so on. So pretty much the structure of gravity is quite fixed.
Because I've always heard, like, okay, if you start with a graviton, if you start with GR and you approximate it, linearize it, then you get a graviton. But if you start with a graviton, not necessarily you get.
Actually, you do. If you start with a graviton, you try to make things consistent. You painfully, step by step, discover the couplings of Einstein gravity plus higher derivative corrections. I don't remember. We might actually. I don't know if we.
We're going to talk about that beta function that you actually mentioned, the GR.
Yeah, in string theory, yes, but this is really fact about quantum field theory too. You can if you look at the scattering amplitudes where you emit a very soft graviton, and you post gauge invariants. You pretty much find that it has to couple to, in a universal way, to particles. And pretty much you end up with these sort of things. So this is more or less the sketch of what string theory is. You start by studying string perturbation theories, you add deep brains to it, you use a bit of supersymmetry to try to explore away from the perturbative regime. You discover dualities that relate different string theories. You say, okay, the thing that is underlying, I call string theory. And all the string theory, all the manifestation of string theories that are well defined that we encounter until now always end up inside this blob. Now, it's conceivable that there might be other blobs. It's conceivable that perhaps if we knew how to define string theory without supersymmetry, or perhaps just other theories of quantum gravity which are not string theory, presume that they might belong to some different blob that is unrelated to this. Finding these other blobs would be great. It would be an incredible discovery. Has been surprisingly hard to do so. For example, there is something called the SCFT, which unfortunately we'll not be able to cover much in this course. It's one of the most important things that came out of string theory. Ultimately, it's it emerged in string theory because it's the mechanism that string theory uses to mimic the behavior of deep brains through perturbation theory of open strings. Somehow, if you look at deep brains in gravity, they can also be understood as sort of something like a black hole, some solution of gravity with some non-trivial space-time there. But in string theory, they're introduced by taking string theory in flat space and adding open strings to it. So the fact that open strings can mimic the presence of a non-trivial gravitational background is due to ADS-CFT, which is a duality between gravity in some number of dimensions and quantum field theory in one less dimension. Now, ADS-CFT exists independently from string theory, but it was originally discovered in string theory by taking a limit of this statement, which got rid of the closed strings and only left to the open strings or the gravitational neighborhood of the D-brains. So ADS-CFT is a general statement that if you have a theory of quantum gravity, which has low energy, which has gravitons at low energy in the spectrum, has a negative cosmological constant, then the theory can also be described by quantum field theory in one less dimension. What's your question? This means that you can define quantum gravities by producing quantum field theories with the correct properties. Again, most of the examples we have available, all examples, are supersymmetric because there is where we can more easily check things. And in all of those examples, the quantum field theories end up producing theories of quantum gravity that fall inside this blob.
How do we tell if we're in this blob or another? Like, what's the criterion?
If you can find some way to deform your theory back to one of these corners, pretty much.
But you said there's discrete choices in this blob. So how do we deform?
No, there are no discrete. So all discrete choices are dynamical.
In the discrete ones.
Yes. So that's why, so this corresponds to different discrete choices in perturbation theory, but they can actually be related dynamically. But I'm not saying it's an easy thing to say, oh, I landed in this blob or I didn't land in this blob. When we can do the calculation, it's usually in situations where we land not just in this blob, but we land here or here, where we can actually check. But again, A would be absolutely great to find a quantum field theory whose holographic dual lands somewhere else. Can't always say a couple more words about this. So for a lot of these examples, it had to happen in the sense that the way these quantum field theories were found was starting from string theory, looking at some D-brains, and deriving quantum field theory. But there are a lot of examples where we didn't do that. There are examples which land in M theory, which were quantum field theories which just happened to be very supersymmetric and very nice, but were not built from string theory, but then they still end up landing inside this blob. It's kind of disturbing, actually. Because one could have hoped to find something else. But perhaps the lesson is that supersymmetric theories of quantum gravity more or less end up living here. So again, it might be again a lamppost issue. Okay, so.
Is that a, do we have any signature of those five theories are essentially like part more of the, what is it? Mm-hmm. Background theory, or what if like just one or few of those are correct and the other is just different theory?
No, you can literally start from this, do something to it, and continue deforming into this.
So we already checked it, like those five are somehow.
Yes, absolutely. Use the string theory revolution that happened some time ago, before I was scientifically born. So. Okay, so what do we use string theory? Yes?
So what is the rule of S theory in that
theory? It's another corner. It's somewhere here. F theory is pretty much type 2B theory in situations where the coupling does not remain weak everywhere, but is allowed to do funny things here and there. Now, so what do we use string theory for? Well, one thing you can use it for is that it describes universes, and you can hope to find your own. it's a nice exercise. It's definitely useful, but to really do it properly, we need to learn more than we know at the moment about string theory, because supersymmetry is a place where we can do calculations. We usually tend to do calculations there. Our world might or not be supersymmetric. And we really don't know how to do calculations in a broad enough range to be able to say something definitive about the possibility of finding our universe or not. Actually, it's also possible that we can find our universe in string theory in many different ways, which is even more bothersome. But again, that's bothersome only if you really hope to stop physics, in a sense. If you're happy with the idea that you can keep looking at shorter and shorter distances to see what's there, then you should be fine with it. Now, string theory also is a useful tool in theoretical physics, independently of the application to theory of everything. We've learned a lot about quantum theory, about theoretical physics from string theory, and there is still a lot to learn in it, probably. We learned about ADS-FT. We learned about dualities. These relations between different string theories often implies the relations between different quantum field theories, which have been very interesting. Then there are applications to more mathematical physics. Often these dualities end up implying deep mathematical relationships, which then turn out to be true. So string theory sort of has tentacles extending into math, extending into quantum field theory, and most of theoretical physics. So this string theory is a tool rather than as a underlying theory of nature. And presumably, just about this course, you're probably going to learn some things that are going to be useful to you independently of the interest being interested in string theory in the long term. We learn a lot of two-dimensional quantum field theory, interesting phenomena, anomalies, things like that. Okay, any more questions? Okay, see you tomorrow.